Who knows what goes on in a family? I learned this as a grad student. You can spend years with a patient and still they'll surprise you, Wesley told me after we'd shaken hands for the first time, his fingers yellow with nicotine. How so? I asked. He settled himself behind his desk, clawed his hair back. You can hear someone's secrets and their fears and their wants, but remember that these exist alongside other people's secrets and fears, people living in the same rooms. You've heard that line about all happy families being the same? War and peace, I said. Anna Karenina, but that's not the point. The point is, it's untrue. No family, happy or unhappy, is quite like another. Tolstoy was chock full of shit. Remember that. I remember it now as I gently thumb the focusing ring, as I frame a photo, a family portrait. But then I set the camera down. Wednesday, November 3. 20. I wake with Wesley in my head. Wesley and a hard-earned hangover. I wade my way down to the study as if through a fog, then run into the bathroom and vomit. Heavenly rapture. As I've discovered, I throw up with great accuracy. I could go pro, Ed says. One flush and the mess slides away. I rinse my mouth, pat some color into my cheeks, return to the study. Across the park, the Russells' windows are empty, their rooms dim. I stare at the house. It stares back. I find I miss them. I look south where a beat-up taxi drags itself down the street. A woman strides in its wake, coffee cup in hand, golden doodle on a leash. I check the clock on my phone, 10:28. How am I up this early? Right. I forgot my temazepam. Well, I keeled over before I could remember it. It keeps me unconscious, weighs me down like a rock. And now last night swirls in my brain, strobe light dazzly, like the carousel from Strangers on a Train. Did that even happen? Yes. We uncorked Jane's wine, we talked boats, we wolfed chocolate, I took a photo. We discussed our families, I arranged my pills across the table, we drank some more. Not in that order. Three bottles of wine. Or was it four? Even so, I can stomach more, have stomached more. The pills, I say, the way a detective cries, Eureka! My dosage. I double-dosed yesterday, I remember. Must be the pills.
I bet those'll knock you on your behind, Jane giggled after I'd downed the lot, chased them with a slug of wine.
My head is quaking. My hands are shaking. I find a travel-sized tube of Advil hidden in the back of my desk drawer, toss three capsules down my throat. The expiration date came and went 9 months ago. Children have been conceived and born in that time, I reflect. Whole lives created. I swallow a fourth, just in case. And then? What then? Yes. Then Alistair arrived, asking after his wife. Motion beyond the window. I look up. It's Dr. Miller leaving the house for work. See you at 3:15, I tell him. Don't be late. Don't be late. That was Wesley's golden rule. For some people, this is the most important 50 minutes of their week, he would remind me. So for Christ's sake, whatever else you do or fail to do, don't be late. Wesley, brilliant. It's been 3 months since I checked up. I grip the mouse and visit Google. The cursor flashes in the search field like a pulse.
He still occupies the same endowed adjunct chair, I see. He's still publishing articles in the Times and assorted industry journals. And he's still in practice, of course, although I recall that the office moved to Yorkville over the summer. I say the office, but really it would have been just Wesley and his receptionist, Phoebe, and her square card reader. And that Eames lounge chair. He adores his Eames. That Eames, but not much else. Wesley never married. His lectureship was his love, his patients, his children.
"Don't you go feeling sorry for poor Dr. Brill, Fox," he warned me.
I remember it perfectly. Central Park, swans with their question mark necks, high noon beyond the Lacey Elms. He'd just asked me to join him as junior partner in the practice.
"My life is too full," he said. "That's why I need you or someone like you. There are more children we can help together."
He was, as ever, right. I click on Google Images. The search yields a small gallery of photographs, none especially recent, none especially flattering.
"I don't photograph well," he once observed,
uncomplaining, a roily halo of cigar smoke churning overhead, his fingernails stained and split.
"You don't," I agreed.
He hitched one bristly brow.
"True or false? You're this tough on your husband."
"Not strictly true." He snorted.
"Something can't be strictly true," he said. "It's either true or it isn't. It's either real or it's not."
"Quite true," I answered. 21.
"Guess who?" Ed says.
I shift in my chair.
"That's my line." "You sound like hell, Slugger."
"Sound and feel."
"Are you sick?"
"I was," I reply. I shouldn't tell him about last night, I know, but I'm too weak. And I want to be honest with Ed. He deserves that. He's displeased.
"You can't do that, Anna. Not on medication."
"I know." Already I regret having said anything.
"But really,
I know," I said. When he speaks again, his voice is softer.
"You've had a lot of visitors lately," he says. "A lot of stimulation."
He pauses.
"Maybe these people across the park,
the Russells,
maybe they can leave you alone for a little while."
"As long as I don't go fainting outside, I'm sure they will."
"You're none of their business."
"And they're none of yours," I bet he's thinking.
"What does Dr. Fielding say?"
he continues. I've come to suspect that Ed asks this whenever he's at a loss. "He's more interested in my relationship with you."
"With me?"
"With both of you."
"Ah."
"Ed, I miss you." I hadn't meant to say it, hadn't even realized I was thinking it. Unfiltered subconscious. "Sorry. That's just the id talking," I explain. He's quiet for a moment. Finally.
"Well, now it's the Ed talking," he says.
"I miss this, too. His stupid puns. He used to tell me I put the Anna in psychoanalyst."
"That's terrible," I'd say, gagging. "You know you love it," he'd reply,
and I did. He's quiet again. Then,
"So what do you miss about me?" I hadn't expected this.
I begin, hoping the sentence will complete itself. And it spouts from me in a torrent, water pluming from a drain, a burst dam. "I miss the way you bowl," I say, "because these idiot words are first to my tongue. I miss how you can never tie a bowline right. I miss your razor burn. I miss your eyebrows." As I speak,
I find myself climbing the stairs past the landing into the bedroom.
I miss your shoes. I miss you asking me for coffee in the morning. I miss that time you wore my mascara and everybody noticed.
I miss that time you actually asked me to sew something.
I miss how polite you are to waiters.
In my bed now, our bed.
I miss your eggs.
Scrambled even when sunny side up.
I miss your bedtime stories.
The heroines rejected the princes, opting instead to pursue their doctorates.
I miss your Nicolas Cage impression.
It got shriller post-Wicker Man.
I miss how for the longest time you thought the word misled was pronounced mizzled.
Misleading little word. It mizzled me.
I laugh wetly and find I'm crying.
I miss your stupid, stupid jokes.
I miss how you always break a piece off a chocolate bar before eating it instead of just biting into the fucking chocolate bar.
Language.
Sorry.
Also, it tastes better that way.
I miss your heart, I say. A pause. I miss you so much. Another pause. I love you so much. I catch my ragged breath. Both of you.
No pattern here. Not that I can see, and I'm trained to discern patterns.
I just miss him. I miss him. I love him. I love them. There's a silence. Long and deep. I breathe.
But Anna,
he tells me gently,
if
a sound downstairs. It's quiet, just a low roll. Possibly the house settling. Wait, I say to Ed. Then clearly a dry cough. A grunt. Someone is in my kitchen. I have to go. I say to Ed,
what?
But I'm already stealing toward the door, phone clutched in one hand. My fingers glance across the screen. 911. And my thumb hovers over the dial button. I remember the last time I called. Called more than once, in fact, or tried to. Someone will answer this time. I stalk down the stairs. Hand slick on the banister, the steps beneath my feet invisible in the dark. Round the corner, and light swerves into the stairwell. I slink into the kitchen. The phone trembles in my hand. There's a man by the dishwasher, his broad back to me. He turns. I press dial. 22.
Hi, David says.
For fuck's sake. I exhale, quickly cancel the call, tuck the phone back into my pocket.
Sorry, he adds. I rang the bell about half an hour ago, but I think you were asleep.
I must have been in the shower, I say. He doesn't react. Probably embarrassed for me. My hair isn't even wet.
So I came up through the basement. Hope that's okay.
Of course it's okay, I tell him. You're welcome to any time. I walk to the sink, fill a glass with water. My nerves are shot.
What did you need me for? I'm looking for an X-Acto.
An X-Acto?
X-Acto knife.
Like a box cutter.
Exactly.
Exactly, I say. What is wrong with me?
I checked under the sink,
he continues mercifully.
And in that drawer by the phone. Your phone's not plugged in, by the way. I think it's dead.
I can't even remember the last time I used the landline. I'm sure it is.
Might want to fix that.
No need, I think. I move back toward the stairs. I've got a box cutter in the utility closet up here, I say, but he's already trailing me. At the landing, I turn and open the closet door. Black as a spent match inside. I yank the string beside the bare bulb. It's a deep, narrow attic of a room, folded beach chairs slumped at the far end, tins of paint like flower pots on the floor, and, improbably, toile wallpaper, shepherdesses and noblemen, the odd urchin. Ed's toolbox sits on a shelf, pristine.
"So I'm not handy," he'd say. "With a body like mine, I don't need to be."
I unlatch the box, rummage.
"There."
David points, a silver plastic sheath, the blade peeking out at one end. I grasp it.
"Careful."
"I won't cut you." I hand it to him gently, the blade aimed toward myself.
"It's you I don't want cut," he says.
A little flicker of pleasure within me, like the bud of a flame. "What are you doing with this anyway?" I tug the string again, and once more it's night in here. David doesn't move. It occurs to me as we stand there in the dark, me in my robe and David with a knife, that this is the closest I've ever been to him. He could kiss me.
He could kill me. The guy next door asked me to do some work, open some boxes, and put some stuff away.
Which guy next door?
The one across the park. Russell.
He walks out, heads for the stairs. "How did he find you?" I ask, following him.
"I put up some flyers. He saw one in the coffee shop or someplace."
He turns and looks at me.
"You know him?"
"No," I say. "He came by yesterday, that's all." We're back in the kitchen.
"He's got some boxes need unpacking and some furniture to assemble in the basement. I should be back sometime in the afternoon."
"I don't think they're there." He squints at me.
"How do you know?"
"Because I watch their house." "It doesn't look like anybody's home." I point to number 207 through the kitchen window, and as I do, their living room flushes with light. Alistair stands there, a phone cradled between cheek and shoulder, his hair just out of bed.
"That's the guy,"
says David, heading toward the hall door.
"I'll be back later. Thanks for the knife."
23. I mean to get back to Ed. "Guess who?" I'll say. My turn this time. But there's a knock on the hall door a moment after David walks through it. I go to see what he needs. A woman stands on the other side, wide-eyed and lissome. Bina. I glance at my phone. Noon exactly. Exactly.
"God. David let me in," she explains. "He gets better looking every time I see him. Where does it end?"
"Maybe you should do something about that," I tell her.
"Maybe you should shut your mouth and get ready to exercise. Go change into real clothes."
I do, and after I've unfurled my mat, we begin, right there on the living room floor. It's been almost 10 months since Bina and I first met. Almost 10 months since I left the hospital. My spine bruised, my throat damaged, and in that time we've become fond of each other. Maybe even friends, as Dr. Fielding said.
"Warm out today."
She lays a weight in the hollow of my back. My elbows wobble.
"You should open a window." "Not happening,"
I grunt.
"You're missing out." "I'm missing out on a lot."
An hour later, with my t-shirt sucking at my skin, she hauls me to my feet.
"Do you want to try that umbrella trick?"
she asks. I shake my head. My hair clings to my neck.
"Not today. And it's not a trick. It's a good day for it. Nice and mild outside." "No, I'm... no." "You're hungover." That, too. A small sigh.
Did you try it with Dr. Fielding this week?
Yes,
I lie. And how was it?
Fine.
How far did you make it?
13 steps. Bina studies me.
All right. Not bad for a lady your age.
Getting older, too.
Why?
When's your birthday? Next week. The 11th. 11-11.
Gonna have to give you a senior's discount.
She bends down, packs her weights into their case.
Let's eat.
I never used to cook much. Ed was the chef. And these days, Fresh Direct delivers my groceries to the door. Frozen dinners, microwave meals, ice cream, wine. Wine in bulk. Also a few portions of lean protein and fruit for Bina's benefit. And my own, she'd argue. Our lunches are off the clock. It seems Bina enjoys the pleasure of my company.
Shouldn't I be paying you for this? I asked her once. You're already cooking for me, she replied.
I scraped a black chunk of chicken onto her plate.
Is that what this is?
Today, it's melon with honey and a few strips of dry bacon.
Definitely uncured?
Bina asks. Definitely.
Thanks, lady.
She spoons fruit into her mouth, brushes honey from her lip.
I was reading an article about how bees can travel 6 miles from their hive in search of pollen. Where did you read that?
The Economist.
Ooh, The Economist. Isn't that amazing?
It's depressing. I can't even leave my house.
The article wasn't about you.
Doesn't sound like it.
And they dance, too. It's called a waggle dance.
She snaps a bacon strip in two.
How did you know that?
There was an exhibit on honeybees at the Pitt Rivers in Oxford when I was there. That's their natural history museum.
Ooh, Oxford.
I remember the waggle dance in particular because we tried to imitate it. A lot of bumbling and thrashing, much like the way I exercise.
Were you drunk?
We were not sober. I've been dreaming about bees ever since I read the article, she says. What do you think that means?
I'm not a Freudian. I don't interpret dreams. But if you did?
If I did, I'd say that the bees represent your urgent need to stop asking me what your dreams mean. She chews.
I'm gonna make you suffer next time.
We eat in silence.
Did you take your pills today?
Yes. I haven't. I'll do it after she leaves. A moment later, water lunges through the pipes. Bina looks toward the stairs.
Was that a toilet?
It was.
Is someone else here?
I shake my head. Swallow. David's got a friend over, sounds like.
What a slut. He's no angel.
Do you know who it is?
I never do. Are you jealous? Definitely not. You wouldn't want a waggle dance with David.
She flicks a crumb of bacon at me.
I've got a conflict next Wednesday, same as last week.
Your sister.
Yes, back for more. Would Thursday work for you?
The odds are excellent.
Hooray.
She chews, swirls her water glass.
You look tired, Anna. Are you resting?
I nod my head, then shake it.
No. Yes, but I've had a lot on my mind lately. This is hard for me, you know. All this.
My arm sweeps the room.
I know it must be. I know it is. And exercise is hard for me.
You're doing really great, I promise. And therapy is hard for me. It's hard to be on the other side of it. I can imagine. I breathe. Don't want to get worked up. One last thing. And I miss Livy and Ed. Bina sets her fork down.
Of course you do, she says.
and her smile is so warm, I could cry.
24. Granny Lizzie.
Hello, Dr. Anna.
The message appears on my desktop screen with a chirp. I set my glass to one side, suspend my chess game. I'm 3-0 since Bina left. A banner day. The doctor is in.
Hello, Lizzie. How are you feeling?
Granny Lizzie.
Doing better, thank you kindly.
The doctor is in.
Great to hear.
Granny Lizzie.
I donated Richard's clothing to our church.
The doctor is in.
I'm sure they appreciated that.
Granny Lizzie.
They did, and it's what Richard would want.
Granny Lizzie.
And the students in my third grade class made a big get-well card for me. It's enormous. Glitter and cotton balls everywhere.
The doctor is in. That's very sweet.
Granny Lizzie. Honestly, I would give it a C+, but it's the thought that counts.
I laugh. LOL, I type, but then I delete it. The doctor is in. I worked with kids, too.
Granny Lizzie. Did you?
The doctor is in.
Child psychology.
Granny Lizzie.
Sometimes I feel like that was my job.
I laugh again. Granny Lizzie.
Whoa, 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 I almost forgot.
Granny Lizzie.
I was able to take a little walk outside this morning. One of my old students dropped by and got me out of the house.
Granny Lizzie.
Just for a moment, but it was worth it.
The doctor is in.
What a terrific step. It will only get easier from here.
That might not be true, but for Lizzie's sake, I hope otherwise.
The doctor is in.
And how wonderful that your students are so fond of you.
Granny Lizzie. This is Sam. No artistic instincts at all. But he was a very nice child, and now he's a very nice man.
Granny Lizzie.
Although I forgot my house key.
The doctor is in.
Understandable.
Granny Lizzie.
Wasn't able to get back inside for a moment.
The doctor is in. I hope that wasn't too frightening.
Granny Lizzie. A little freaky, but I keep a spare in our flower pot. I have beautiful violets in bloom.
The doctor is in.
We don't have that luxury in NYC.
Granny Lizzie.
Laughing out loud.
I smile. She hasn't quite mastered it.
Granny Lizzie. I must go make lunch. Friend coming over.
The doctor is in.
Go do that. I'm glad you have company.
Granny Lizzie.
Thank you.
Granny Lizzie. Smiley face. She logs out, and I feel radiant. I may do some good before I am dead. Jude. Part 6, Chapter 1. 5 o'clock, and all's well. I finish my match, 4-0. Sip the last of my wine and walk downstairs to the television. A Hitchcock doubleheader tonight, I think, as I open the DVD cabinet. Maybe Rope, underrated, and Strangers on a Train, Crisscross. Both starring gay actors. I wonder if that's why I paired them. I'm still on my analyst's kick. Crisscross, I say to myself. I've been monologuing a lot lately. Stick a pin in that for Dr. Fielding. Or perhaps North by Northwest, or The Lady Vanish. A scream, raw and horror-struck, torn from the throat. I spin toward the kitchen windows. The room is silent. My heart drums. Where did it come from? Waves of honeyed evening light outside, wind shifting in the trees. Was it from the street, or... And then again,
dredged from the deep, shredding the air, full-blooded and frenzied. That scream. Coming from number 207. The parlor windows gape, the curtains restless in the breeze. "Warm out today," Bina had said. "You should open a window." I stare at the house, my eyes flicking between the kitchen and parlor, swerving up to Ethan's bedroom, back to the kitchen. Is he attacking her? Very controlling. I don't have their number. I wriggle my iPhone from my pocket, drop it on the floor. Fuck. And dial directory assistance.
What address?
Sullen. I answer. A moment later, an automated voice recites 10 digits, offers to repeat them in Spanish. I hang up, punch the number into the phone. A ring, purring in my ear. Another ring. A third. Hello? Ethan. Shaky. Quiet. I scan the side of the house, but can't find him. It's Anna, across the park. A sniffle. Hi. What's going on there? I heard a scream.
Oh. No. No.
He coughs. It's fine. I heard someone scream. Was that your mom? It's fine, he repeats. He just lost his temper. Do you need help? A pause.
No.
Two tones stutter in my ear. He's hung up. His house looks at me neutrally. David. David's over there today. Or has he returned? I rap on the basement door, call his name. For an instant, I fear that a stranger will open the door, explain sleepily that David's due back in a little while, and would you mind if I went back to bed, thanks so much? Nothing. Did he hear it? Did he see it? I ring his number. Four tones, long and unhurried, then a generic recorded greeting. We're sorry, the person you have called. A woman's voice. Always a woman. Maybe we sound more apologetic. I press cancel. Stroke the phone as though it's a magic lamp and a genie will spout forth, ready to dispense his wisdom, grant my wishes. Jane screamed. Twice. Her son denied that anything was wrong. I can't summon the police. If he wouldn't come clean to me, he certainly won't say anything to men in uniform. My nails carve sickles into my palm. No, I need to speak to him again, or better still, to her. I jab the recent button on my screen, press the Russell's number. It rings just once before it's picked up.
Yes?
Says Alistair in his pleasant tenor. I catch my breath. I look up. There he is in the kitchen, phone at his ear, a hammer in his other hand. He doesn't see me. This is Anna Fox from number 213. We met last...
Yes, I remember. Hello.
Hello, I say, then wish I hadn't. I heard a scream just now, so I wanted to check on... Turning his back to me, he places the hammer on the counter. The hammer. Was that what alarmed her? And claps his hand to the nape of his neck as if he's comforting himself.
Sorry, you heard a what?
He asks. I hadn't expected this. A scream? I say. No. Make it authoritative. A scream. A minute ago.
A scream?
Like it's a foreign word. Sprezzatura. Schadenfreude.
Scream.
Yes.
From where?
From your house. Turn around. I want to see your face.
There's been no scream here. I can promise you that.
I hear him chuckle. Watch him lean against the wall. But I heard it. And your son confirmed it, I think, although I won't tell him that. It might aggravate him, might incense him.
I think you must have heard something else, or heard it from somewhere else.
No, I distinctly heard it from your house.
The only people here are myself and my son. I didn't scream, and I'm pretty sure he didn't either.
But I heard... Mrs. Fox, I'm so sorry, but I have to go. I've got another call coming in. Everything's fine here. No scream, I promise you.
You have a good day. Enjoy the weather.
I watch him hang up, hear those two tones again. He lifts the hammer from the counter, leaves the room through a far door. I gawk at my phone in disbelief, as if it might explain things to me. And just then, as I look back toward the Russell house, I see her on her front stoop. She stands still for a moment, like a meerkat sensing a predator before descending the steps. Twists her head that way, then this, then that way again. Finally, she walks west toward the avenue, the crown of her head a halo in the sunset. 25. He leans in the doorway, shirt dark with sweat, hair matted. An earbud is plugged into one ear.
What's that?
Did you hear that scream at the Russells? I repeat. I heard him return just now, barely 30 minutes after Jane appeared on the stoop. In the meantime, my Nikon has veered from window to window at the Russell house, like a dog snouting out foxholes.
No, I left about a half hour ago, David says. Went down to the coffee shop for a sandwich.
He lifts his shirt to his face, mops up the sweat. His stomach is corrugated.
You heard a scream?
Two of them, loud and clear, around 6 o'clock. He eyes his watch.
I might have been there, only I didn't hear much, he says, pointing to the earbud.
The other swings against his thigh.
Except for Springsteen.
It's practically the first personal preference he's ever expressed. But the timing is off. I steam ahead. Mr. Russell didn't say you were there. He said it was just him and his son.
Then I'd probably left.
I called you. It sounds like a plea. He frowns, takes his phone from his pocket, looks at it, frowns deeper as though the phone has let him down.
Oh, you need something?
So you didn't hear anyone scream?
I didn't hear anyone scream.
I turn.
You need something?
He says again, but I'm already moving toward the window, camera in hand. I see him as he sets out. The door opens, and when it closes, there he is. He trips quickly down the steps, turns left, marches along the sidewalk, toward my house. When the bell rings a moment later, I'm already waiting by the buzzer. I press it, hear him enter the hall, hear the front door crack shut behind him. I open the hall door to find him standing there in the dark, eyes red and raw, the blood vessels frayed within them.
I'm sorry,
Ethan says, hovering on the threshold. Don't be. Come in. He moves like a kite, feinting first toward the sofa, then to the kitchen. Do you want something to eat? I ask him.
No, I can't stay.
Shaking his head, tears skittering down his face. Twice this child has set foot in my house, and twice he's cried. Of course, I'm accustomed to children in distress. Weeping, shouting, pummeling dolls, flaying books. It used to be that Olivia was the only one I could hug. Now I open my arms to Ethan, spread them wide like wings, and he walks into them awkwardly, as though bumping into me. For an instant, and then for a moment, I'm holding my daughter again, holding her before her first day of school, holding her in the swimming pool on our vacation in Barbados, clutching her amid the silent snowfall, her heart beating against my own, a beat apart, a continuous drumline, blood surging through us both. He mutters something indistinct against my shoulder.
What's that?
I said I'm really sorry, he repeats,
prying himself free, skidding his sleeve beneath his nose.
I'm really sorry.
It's fine. Stop saying that. It's fine. I brush a lock of hair from my eye, do the same for him. What's going on?
My dad.
He stops, glances through the window at his house. In the dark, it glowers like a skull.
My dad was yelling, and I needed to get out of the house.
Where's your mom? He sniffles, swipes at his nose again.
I don't know.
A couple of deep breaths, and he looks me in the eye.
Sorry. I don't know where she is. She's fine, though.
Is she? He sneezes, looks down. Punch has slipped between his feet, grating his body against Ethan's shins. Ethan sneezes again.
Sorry.
Another sniffle.
Cat.
He looks around as if surprised to find himself in my kitchen.
I should go back. My dad'll be angry.
Sounds as though he's already angry. I tug a chair back from the table, gesture to it. He considers the chair, then darts his eyes back to the window.
I've got to go. I shouldn't have come over.
You needed to get out of the house, I finish. I understand. But is it safe to go back? To my surprise, he laughs, short and spiky.
He talks big, that's all. I'm not afraid of him.
But your mom is. He says nothing. As far as I can see, Ethan doesn't display any of the more obvious hallmarks of child abuse. His face and forearms are unmarked, his demeanor bright and outgoing. Although he has cried twice, let's not forget that, his hygiene satisfactory. But this is just an impression, just a glance. And he is, after all, standing here in my kitchen, slinging nervous looks at his home across the park. I push the chair back into place. I want you to have my cell number, I tell him. He nods, grudgingly, I think, but it'll do.
Could you write it down for me? He asks.
You don't have a phone? A shake of the head.
My dad won't let me.
He sniffles.
I don't have email either.
Not surprising. I fetch an old receipt from a kitchen drawer, scribble on it. 4 digits in, I realize I'm writing out my old work number, the emergency line I reserved for my patients. 1-800-ANNA-NOW, Ed used to joke. Sorry, wrong number. I slash a line through it, then jot down the correct one. When I look up again, he's standing by the kitchen door, looking across the park at his house. You don't have to go back there, I say. He turns, hesitates, shakes his head.
I've got to head home.
I nod, offer him the paper. He pockets it. You can call me any time, I say, and share that number with your mom, too, please.
Okay.
He's moving toward the door, shoulders back, back straight. Bracing for battle, I think. Ethan? He turns, one hand on the doorknob. I mean it. Any time. He nods. Then he opens the door and walks out. I return to the window, watch him walk past the park, climb the steps, push his key into the lock. He pauses, draws a breath. Then he disappears inside. 26. 2 hours later, I sluice the last of the wine down my throat. Stand the bottle on the coffee table. I prop myself up slowly, then tip to the other side like the second hand of a clock. No. Haul yourself to your bedroom, to your bathroom. With the shower gushing, The last few days flood my brain, filling the fissures there, welling up in the hollows. Ethan, crying on the couch. Dr. Fielding and his high-voltage glasses. Bina, her leg braced against my spine. That whirlpool of a night when Jane visited. Ed's voice in my ear. David with the knife. Alistair. A good man. A good father. Those screams. I squeeze a slug of shampoo into one hand, smear it absently into my hair. The tide rises at my feet. And the pills. God, the pills.
These are powerful psychotropics, Anna, Dr. Fielding advised me at the very beginning, back when I was woolly on painkillers. Use them responsibly.
I press my palms against the wall, hang my head beneath the faucet, my face lurking within a dark cave of hair. Something's happening to me, through me. Something dangerous and new. It's taken root. A poison tree. It's grown, fanning out, vines winding round my gut, my lungs, my heart. The pills, I say. My voice soft and low amid the roar, like I'm speaking underwater. My hand sketches hieroglyphs on the glass. I clear my eyes and read them. Over and over across the door, I've written Jane Russell's name. Thursday, November 4. 27. He lies on his back. I run a finger along the fence of dark hair that partitions his torso from navel to chest. I like your body, I tell him. He sighs and smiles.
Don't,
he says. And then, with my hand idling in the shallows of his neck, he catalogues his every flaw. The dry skin that makes terrazzo of his back. The single mole between his shoulder blades, like an Eskimo marooned on an expanse of flaggy ice. His warped thumbnail. His knobbed wrists. The tiny white scar that hyphenates his nostrils. I finger the wound. My pinky dips into his nose. He snorts. How did it happen? I ask. He twists my hair around his thumb.
My cousin.
I didn't know you had a cousin.
Two. This was my cousin Robin. He held a razor against my nose and said he'd slit my nostrils so that I only had one. And when I shook my head no, the blade sliced me.
God! He exhales.
I know. If I'd only nodded okay, it would have been fine.
I smile. How old were you?
Oh, this was last Tuesday.
Now I laugh, and so does he. As I surface, the dream drains away like water. The memory, really. I try to scoop it up in my palms, but it's gone. I press a hand against my forehead, hoping to smooth away the hangover. Cast the sheets to one side, ditch my nightclothes as I walk to the dresser, check the clock on the wall. 10:10, a waxed mustache on its face. I slept for 12 hours. Yesterday has faded like a flower, yellow and wilted. A domestic dispute, unpleasant but not uncommon, that's what I heard. Overheard, really. It's none of my business. Perhaps Ed is right, I think, as I clop down to my study. Of course he's right.
A lot of stimulation.
Yes, indeed. Too much. I'm sleeping too much. Drinking too much. Thinking too much. Too much, too much. De trop.
Did I involve myself like this with the Millers when they arrived back in August? They never visited me, no, but still, I studied their routines, tracked their movements, tagged them like sharks in the wild. So it isn't that the Russells are particularly interesting, they're just particularly nearby. I'm concerned for Jane, naturally, and especially for Ethan. He just lost his temper. That must be a pretty ferocious temper. But I can't approach, say, Child Protective Services. There's nothing to go on. At this point, it would do more harm than good. That I know. My phone rings. This happens so infrequently that for a moment, I'm confused. I look outside as though it's a bird call. The phone isn't in the pockets of my robe. I hear it buzzing somewhere above me. By the time I've reached my bedroom and found it in the trough of sheets, it's gone mute. The screen reads, Julian Fielding. I hit redial.
Hello?
Hi, Dr. Fielding. I missed you just now.
Anna. Hello.
Hello. Hi. Many benedictions all around. My head throbs.
I'm calling. 1 minute.
His voice shrinks, then returns hard in my ear.
I'm in an elevator. I'm calling to make sure you filled your prescription.
What prescription? Ah, yes. The pills Jane collected for me at the door. I did, in fact.
Good. I hope you don't think this patronizing, me checking in on you.
I do, in fact. Not at all.
You should experience the effects quite quickly.
The rattan on the stairs scratches at my soles. Swift results.
Well, I'd call them effects rather than results.
No shower pisser he. I'll keep you posted, I assure him, descending to the study.
I felt concerned after our last session.
I pause. No, I don't know what to say.
My hope is that this adjustment in your medication will help.
Still, I say nothing.
Anna?
Yes, I hope so too. His voice shrivels again. Sorry? A second later, he's at full volume.
These pills, he says, are not to be taken with alcohol.
28. In the kitchen, I chase the pills with Merlot. I understand Dr. Fielding's concern. I do. I recognize that alcohol is a depressant and, as such, ill-suited to a depressive. I get it. I've written about it. Juvenile Depression and Alcohol Abuse, Journal of Pediatric Psychology, Volume 37, Number 4. Wesley Brill, co-author. I can quote our conclusions if necessary. As Bernard Shaw said,
I often quote myself. It adds spice to my conversation.
As Shaw also said,
alcohol is the anesthesia by which we endure the operation of life.
Good old Shaw. So come on, Julian. These aren't antibiotics. Besides, I've been mixing my medicines for almost a year, and look at me now. My laptop sits in a pane of sunlight on the kitchen table. I pry it open, visit the agora, walk two new recruits through the drill, weigh in on yet another drug debate.
None of them are to be taken with alcohol, I preach.
Once, only once, I cast a quick look at the Russell house. There's Ethan tapping away at his desk, playing a game, I suppose, or writing a paper. Not surfing the internet, anyway. And in the parlor, Alistair sits with a tablet propped in his lap. A 21st century family. No Jane, but that's fine. None of my business. Too much stimulation.
Goodbye, Russells, I say, and turn my attention to the television.
Gaslight. Ingrid Bergman, never more luscious, slowly going insane.
29. Sometime after lunch, I'm back at the laptop when I see Granny Lizzie enter the Agora, the little icon beside her name morphing into a smiley face, as though to be present on this forum is a pleasure and a joy. I decide to beat her to the punch. The doctor is in. Hello, Lizzie.
Granny Lizzie.
Hello, Dr. Anna.
The doctor is in.
How's the weather in Montana?
Granny Lizzie.
Rainy outside, which is okay for an indoor gal like me.
Granny Lizzie.
How's the weather in New York City?
Granny Lizzie.
Do I sound like a hillbilly saying that? Should I just say NYC?
The doctor is in.
Both work. It's sunny here.
How are you doing?
Granny Lizzie. Today has been tougher than yesterday, to be honest, so far.
I sip, roll the wine around my tongue. The doctor is in.
That happens. Progress isn't always smooth.
Granny Lizzie.
I can tell that. My neighbors are bringing groceries to me at home.
The doctor is in.
How terrific that you've got such supportive people around you.
Two typos, more than two glasses of wine.
That's a pretty decent batting average, I think.
Pretty damn decent, I say to myself, sipping again. Granny Lizzie.
But the big news is that my sons will be visiting me this weekend. Really want to be able to go outside with them. Really, really.
The doctor is in.
Don't be hard on yourself if it's not meant to be this time around.
A pause. Granny Lizzie.
I know this is a harsh word, but it's difficult for me not to feel like a freak.
Harsh indeed, and it needles my heart. I drain my glass, pull back the sleeves of my robe, rush my fingers over the keyboard. The doctor is in.
You are not a freak. You are a victim of circumstance. What you're going through is hard as hell. I've been housebound for 10 months, and I know as well as anyone how difficult this is. Please don't ever think of yourself as a freak or a loser or anything other than a tough and resourceful person who's been brave enough to ask for help. Your sons should be proud of you, and you should be proud of yourself.
Fin. Not poetry. Not even decent English. My fingers slipped on and off the keys, but every word is true. Strictly true.
Granny Lizzie. That's wonderful.
Granny Lizzie.
Thank you.
Granny Lizzie.
No wonder you're a psychologist. You know just what to say and how to say it.
I feel the smile spreading across my lips.
Granny Lizzie, do you have a family of your own?
The smile freezes. Before answering, I pour myself more wine. It brims at the lip of the glass. I bow my head, slurp it down to high tide. A drop rolls off my lip, down my chin, onto my robe. I smear it into the terry cloth.
Good thing Ed isn't watching. Good thing nobody's watching.
The doctor is in.
I do. But we don't live together.
Granny Lizzie.
Why not?
Why not, indeed. Why don't you live together, Anna? I lift the glass to my mouth, set it down again. The scene unfolds before me like a Japanese fan, the vast flats of snow, the chocolate box hotel, the ancient ice machine. And to my surprise, I begin to tell her.
30. We'd decided 10 days earlier to separate. That's the starting point. The once upon a time. Or rather, to be entirely fair, to be strictly true, Ed had decided, and I had agreed, in principle. I admit I didn't think it would happen, not even when he summoned the broker. Could have fooled me. Why, I reason, isn't for Lizzie to concern herself with. With which it is not for Lizzie to concern herself, as Wesley might insist. He was a stickler for dangling prepositions. I assume he still is. But no, the why isn't important, not here. The where and the when I can provide. Vermont and last December, respectively, when we packed Olivia into the Audi and revved onto 9A over the Henry Hudson Bridge and out of Manhattan. 2 hours later, wending through upstate New York, we'd hit what Ed liked to call the back roads, with lots of diners and pancake places for us, he promised Olivia. Mom doesn't like pancakes, she said. She can go to a crafts store. Mom doesn't like crafts, I said. As it turned out, the back roads of the region are remarkably fallow when it comes to pancake places and crafts stores. We found a single lonely IHOP in easternmost New York, where Olivia dredged her waffles in maple syrup. Locally sourced, claimed the menu, and Ed and I arrowed glances at each other across the table. Outside, a light snow began to shake down, frail little kamikaze flakes smiting themselves against the windows. Olivia pointed with her fork and squealed. I jousted her fork with my own. There'll be a lot more of that at Blue River, I told her. This was our final destination, a ski resort in central Vermont that Olivia's friend had visited. Classmate, not friend. Back to the car, back on the road. The ride was quiet, on the whole. We hadn't said anything to Olivia. No sense spoiling her vacation, I'd argued, and Ed nodded. We'd forge ahead for her. So, in silence, we swept past broad fields and little streams lacquered with ice, through forgotten villages and into a feeble snowstorm near the Vermont border. At one point, Olivia burst into over the meadow and through the woods, and I piled on, trying and failing to harmonize. Daddy, will you sing? Olivia pleaded. She's always done that. Asked rather than ordered. Unusual in a child. Unusual in anyone, I sometimes think. Ed cleared his throat and sang. It was only as we reached the green mountains, bulging like shoulders from the earth, that he began to thaw. Olivia had gone breathless. I've never seen such things, she wheezed, and I wondered where she'd heard those words in that order. Do you like the mountains? I asked. They look like a rumpled blanket. They do. Like a giant's bed. A giant's bed? Ed repeated. Yes, like a giant is sleeping under a blanket. That's why it's all lumpy. You'll be skiing on some of those mountains tomorrow, Ed promised as we hugged a tight turn. We'll go up, up, up in the ski lift and then down, down, down the mountain. Up, 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 she repeated. The words popped from her lips. You got it. Down, down, down. You got it again. That one looks like a horse. Those are his ears. She pointed at a pair of spindly peaks in the distance. Olivia was at that age when everything reminded her of a horse.
Ed smiled. What would you call a horse if you had one, Liv?
We are not getting a horse, I added.
I'd call him Vixen.
A vixen is a fox, Ed told her. A girl fox.
He would be fast like a fox.
We considered this.
What would you call a horse, Mom?
Don't you want to call me Mommy?
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, Mommy. I'd call a horse, of course, of course.
I looked at Ed. Nothing.
Why? Asked Olivia.
It's from a song on TV.
What song?
From an old show about a talking horse.
A talking horse?
She wrinkled her nose.
That's dumb.
I agree.
Daddy, what would you call a horse?
Ed glanced in the rear view. I like Vixen, too.
Whoa, Olivia breathed.
I turned. Space had opened up beside us, beneath us. A vast chasm gutted from the land below, a huge bowl of nothing. Thatched evergreens at the bottom of the void, rags of mist caught in midair. We were so close to the edge of the road that it felt like floating. We could peer into the well of the world.
How far down is that? She asked.
Far, I answered, turning to Ed. Can we slow up a bit?
Slow up?
Slow down, whatever? Just, can we go slower?
He decelerated slightly.
Can we slow down more?
We're fine, he said.
It's scary,
said Olivia, her voice curled up at the edges, hands edging toward her eyes, and Ed eased up on the gas.
Don't look down, Pumpkin, I said, twisting in my seat. Look at Mommy.
She did so, her eyes wide. I took her hand, gathered her fingers in my own.
Everything's fine, I told her. Just look at Mommy.
We'd arranged to lodge outside Two Pines, about half an hour from the resort. Central Vermont's finest historic inn, bragged the Fisher Arms on its website, a slick collage of hearths in full bloom and windows frilly with snow. We parked in the small lot. Icicles hung like fangs from the eaves above the front door. Rustic New England decor within. Steeply pitched ceiling, shabby genteel furniture, flames playing in one of those photo-friendly fireplaces. The receptionist, a plump young blonde whose name tag read Marie, invited us to sign the guest registry, primped the irises on the desk as we did so. I wondered if she was going to address us as folks.
You folks here to ski?
We are, I said. Blue River.
Glad you made it.
Marie beamed at Olivia.
Storm's coming in. Nor'easter?
Suggested Ed, trying to sound local. She trained her laser smile on him.
A nor'easter is more of a coastal storm, sir.
He nearly flinched.
Oh. This is just a storm, but it'll be a whopper. You folks be sure to lock your windows tonight.
I wanted to ask why the windows would be unlocked the week before Christmas, but Marie dropped the keys into my palm and wished us folks a pleasant evening. We trundled our luggage down the hall. The Fisher Arms' many amenities did not include bellhop service, and entered our suite. Paintings of pheasant flanked the fireplace. Layer cakes of blankets sat on the edges of the beds. Olivia made straight for the toilet, leaving the door ajar. She was afraid of strange bathrooms.
It's nice, I murmured.
Liv, Ed called, what's the bathroom like?
Cold.
Which bed do you want?
Ed asked me. On holidays, he and I always slept separately, so that Olivia wouldn't crowd the bed when she inevitably climbed in. Some nights she ferried herself from Ed's bed to my own and back again. He called her Pong after that Atari game with a 4-bit ball bouncing between two bars.
You take the one by the window.
I sat on the edge of the other bed, unzipped my suitcase.
Better make sure it's locked.
Ed swung his bag onto the mattress. We began to unpack in silence. Beyond the window, curtains of snow shifted, gray and white in the creeping dusk. After a moment, he rolled up one sleeve and scratched at his forearm.
You know,
he said. I turned to him. The toilet flushed, and Olivia burst into the room, hopping from one foot to the other.
When can we get up to ski?
Dinner was to be pre-packed PB&Js and assorted juice boxes, although I'd stowed a bottle of Sauvignon Blanc amid my sweaters. By now the wine was room temperature, and Ed liked his whites really dry and really cold, as he always notified waiters. I rang the front desk, asked for ice.
There's a machine in the hallway just past your room, Marie told me. Make sure to give the lid a real hard push.
I took the ice bucket from the minibar beneath the television, walked into the corridor, spotted an old Luma Comfort model humming in an alcove a few steps away.
You sound like a mattress, I informed it.
I gave the lid a real hard push, and back it slid. The machine exhaling into my face, frosty cold, the way people's breath looks in spearmint gum commercials. There was no trowel. I rummaged within, the cold scorching my hands, and shook the cubes into the bucket. They clung to my skin. So much for Luma Comfort. That's where Ed found me, wrist deep in ice. He appeared suddenly at my side, leaning against the wall. For a moment, I pretended not to see him. I stared into the basin of the machine as though its contents fascinated me and continued to scoop ice, wishing he'd leave, wishing he'd hold me.
Interesting.
I turned to him, didn't bother feigning surprise.
Look, he said,
and in my head I completed the sentence for him.
Let's rethink this,
maybe.
I've overreacted, even.
Instead, he coughed. He'd been battling a cold in recent days, ever since the night of the party. I waited. Then he spoke.
I don't want to do it this way.
I squeezed a fistful of ice cubes.
Do what?
My heart felt faint.
Do what?
I repeated.
This,
he answered, almost hissing, sweeping one arm through the air.
A whole happy family holiday, and then the day after Christmas we...
My heart slowed. My fingers burned.
What do you want to do? Tell her now?
He didn't say anything. I withdrew my hand from the machine, slid the lid shut. Not real hard enough. It jammed halfway down. I propped the bucket of ice on my hip, tugged at the lid. Ed gripped it and yanked it. The bucket rolled away from me, clattering to the carpet, spattering cubes across the floor.
Shit. Forget it, he said. I don't want anything to drink. I do.
I knelt to rake the cubes back into the bucket. Ed watched me.
What are you going to do with those? He asked.
Should I just let them melt?
Yes.
I stood and set the bucket atop the machine.
You seriously want to do this now?
He sighed.
I don't see why we... Because we're already here. We're already...
I pointed to the door of our suite. He nodded.
I thought about that. You've been thinking a lot lately. I thought,
he continued,
that...
He went quiet, and I heard the click of a door behind me. I twisted my head to see a middle-aged woman moving down the corridor toward us. She smiled shyly, eyes averted, picked her way through the ice cubes on the floor, walked on to the lobby.
"I thought that you'd want to start healing right away. That's what you'd say to one of your patients. Don't, please, don't tell me what I would or wouldn't say."
He said nothing.
"And I wouldn't talk that way to a child. You'd talk that way to their parents. Don't tell me how I'd talk."
More nothing. "And as far as she knows, there's nothing to heal." He sighed again, rubbed at a spot on the bucket.
"The fact is, Anna," he told me, and I could see the weight in his eyes, that broad cliff of his brow near collapse. "I just can't take this any longer."
I looked down, stared at the ice cubes already softening on the ground. Neither of us spoke. Neither of us moved. I didn't know what to say. Then I heard my voice, soft and low.
"Don't blame me when she's upset."
A pause, and then his voice, softer still.
"I do blame you."
He breathed in, breathed out.
"I thought of you as the girl next door," he said.
I braced myself for more.
"But right now, I can barely look at you."
I screwed my eyes shut, inhaled the cold tang of ice. And I thought not of our wedding day, nor of the night Olivia was born, but of the morning we harvested cranberries in New Jersey. Olivia shrieking and laughing in her waders, buttery with sunblock. Slow skies above, the September sun drenching us. A vast sea of rose-red fruit all around. Ed with his hands full, his eyes bright. Me clutching our daughter's sticky fingers. I remembered the bog waters risen to our hips, felt them flood my heart, surge into my veins, rise within my eyes. I looked up, gazed into Ed's eyes, those dark brown eyes.
"Completely ordinary eyes," he assured me on our second date.
But to me, they were beautiful. They still are. He looked back at me. The ice machine thrummed between us. Then we went to tell Olivia. 31. The doctor is in. Then we went to tell Olivia. I pause. How much more would she want to know? How much more can I bear to tell her? My heart already hurts, aching within my chest. A minute later, there's still no response. I wonder if all this is hitting too close to home for Lizzie. Here I am talking about a separation from my husband when she's lost hers irrevocably. I wonder if... Granny Lizzie has left the chat. I stare at the screen. Now I have to remember the rest of the story on my own. 32.
"Don't you get lonely up here by yourself?"
I wriggle from sleep as a voice questions me, male, flat. I unpaste my eyelids.
"I was born lonely, I guess."
A woman now. Creamy contralto. Light and shadow flicker in my vision. It's dark passage. Bogey and Bacall making bedroom eyes across a coffee table.
"Is that why you visit murder trials?"
On my own coffee table stands the remnants of my dinner. Two drained hollow bottles of Merlot and four canisters of pills.
"No. I went because your case was like my father's."
I swat at the remote beside me. Swat again.
I know he didn't kill my stepmother.
The TV goes dark, and the living room with it.
How much have I drunk? Right. 2 bottles worth, plus lunchtime. That's a lot of wine. I can admit it. And the drugs. Did I take the right quantity this morning? Did I take the right pills? I've been sloppy lately, I know. No wonder Dr. Fielding thinks I'm getting worse. You've been bad, I chide myself.
I peek into the canisters. One of them is almost depleted. 2 tablets crouch within it, little white pellets at either side of the bottle.
God, I'm very drunk.
I look up, look at the window. Dark outside, deep night. I cast about for my phone, can't find it. The grandfather clock looming in the corner ticks as though trying to get my attention.
9:50. 9:50, I say. Not great. Try 10 to 10. 10 to 10. Better.
I nod to the clock.
Thanks, I tell him.
He gazes at me all solemn-like, lurching toward the kitchen now.
Lurching? Isn't that how Jane Russell described me that day at the door? Those little shits with their eggs? Lurch.
From the Adams family. The gangly butler.
Olivia loves that theme song.
Snap, snap. I grasp the faucet, duck my head beneath it, jerk the handle toward the ceiling, a whip of white water. Plunge my mouth forth, gulp deeply. Drag 1 hand along my face, totter back to the living room. My eyes wander across the Russell's house. There's the ghost glow of Ethan's computer, with the kid bent over the desk. There's the empty kitchen. There's their parlor, merry and bright. And there's Jane, in a snow-white blouse, sitting on that striped love seat. I wave. She doesn't see me. I wave again. She doesn't see me. 1 foot, then the other, then the first foot, then the other. Don't forget the other. I melt into the sofa, loll my head on my shoulder, shut my eyes. What happened to Lizzie? Did I say something wrong? I feel myself frown. The cranberry bog stretches before me, shimmering, shifting. Olivia's hand takes my own. The ice bucket smashes on the floor. I'll watch the rest of the movie. I open my eyes, unearth the remote from beneath me. The speakers exhale organ music, and there's Bacall playing peekaboo over her shoulder.
You'll be all right, she vows. Hold your breath. Cross your fingers.
The surgery scene. Bogey doped up. Specters revolving before him, an unholy carousel.
It's in your bloodstream now,
the organ drones.
Let me in.
Agnes Moorhead rapping at the camera lens.
Let me in.
A flame wavers.
Light,
suggests the cabbie.
Light.
I turn my head, look into the Russell house. Jane is still in her living room, on her feet now, shouting silently. I swivel in my seat. Strings, a fleet of them, the organ shrilling beneath. I can't see who she's shouting at, or at whom she's shouting. The wall of the house blocks my view of the rest of the room.
Hold your breath. Cross your fingers.
She's really bellowing, her face gone scarlet. I spy my Nikon on the kitchen counter.
It's in your bloodstream now.
I rise from the sofa, cross to the kitchen, paw the camera with one hand, move to the window.
Let me in, let me in, let me in.
I lean into the glass, lift the camera to my eye, a blur of black, and then Jane jumps into view, soft around the edges. A twist of the lens, and now she's clear, crisp. I can even see her locket winking.